Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Quote, the conscience and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, ideas suggested largely by men we've never heard of. And
they who pull the wires that control the public mind.
Yeah. And honestly, when I wrote Test Drive Your Future, you know, these years ago, I had no idea that that was happening.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is January 16th. I'm very excited to be sharing with you today the continuation of my conversation with Jim Hood from Test Drive Your Future. Every month, Jim and I do an installment on problems and solutions for young people in the theater of college and career decisions. I was happy I could recruit Jim for this project. He has worked hard over the last decade to make himself an expert on this subject matter. We started last month with an episode called Six Mistakes We Made in College. And you might remember in that last show, I said I wanted to dig into mistake number five deeper. I wanted to devote a whole show to that self-knowledge for teens question. I think the mistake language was not knowing yourself as well as you think you do. Because I thought, and now that the conversation is over, I will confirm that I was correct, that it would lead to a very dynamic dialogue about the importance of knowing yourself as well as you possibly can at that age before making huge life decisions like college, career, etc., and how to do that, and the obstacles that are in the way of that self-knowledge that most young people and even most old people never realize are there. It's all in the conversation today. And even if you have realized these things, I think all of this is always worth another probe, you know? So that's what we're going to do today. And that's why I use that Edward Bernays quote that Jim read to open the show. We did hit most of what we put on the outline. We also wandered away from it in some very delightful ways. And I really appreciate Jim's contribution to School Sucks over the last couple months, and I look forward to this continuing. If you want to learn more about his work, you can find links in the show notes for Test Drive Your Future. And Jim is also going to talk about a PDF resource that he's made available for this audience. That is linked in the show notes as well. Other than that, if you heard the early version or the Patreon version of the last podcast, 635, I just want to let everybody know that all of our Podomatic technical issues are resolved. Our situation has improved. There was actually nothing to worry about there except for the service being down for at least 5 days. But everything is now A-OK, and we press on. Thank you so much for listening. Here's my conversation with Jim Hood. Watch out. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Brett.
It's been very Hawaiian here in Pittsburgh lately. I want to tell you, it was 70 degrees the other day.
Oh, man. Well, it's been very Pittsburgh-y here in on the Big Island that we've been getting down into the 50s at night. And I really feel badly for anybody who has come to Hawaii for the first time this last week because the weather has been crap.
You don't have like a time of year you got to worry about there?
Well, I mean, this is kind of it. But I mean, I also live up at 2,500 feet. So we experience more winter here than we do elsewhere. But yeah, this is our high season. We've got dozens of private jets down at the Kona Airport, all of the big wigs with their, you know, multi-million dollar houses down on the coast are all here visiting. And unfortunately, they were all sitting inside last week because it was so nasty.
Right. So we are picking up our monthly series. The first installment, we talked about six mistakes that we made when we were in college. It was based on an article that you wrote, but I made them all too. And I said we were going to table number five, which was assuming you know yourself better than you do. And we would use that as a doorway into a discussion about self-knowledge for teens. And you know, part of me, Jim, wants to throw up my hands and say, how could you possibly know? How could you possibly do this at 17 years old? We were talking before we started recording about a values assessment you did in your early 30s, like 10 years ago. And I said, imagine doing it when you're 22. Right. And you're just talking about like what a huge difference there was in 10 years. And I think I would be in the same place.
Yeah. And that's what I have experienced as well. I was really amazed to see how different my values are in relation to certain aspects of my life just from 10, 11 years ago. But what I also noticed is some of the things that were absolutely most important to me then are still the same now. The idea of financial security has always been something that's been really important to me. My family, my health. Health has gotten bigger. it's gotten more important as I've gotten older. Which has been a surprise these last few years. But humor has something that's always been important to me. Family has really become huge for me now that my wife and I have a little girl.
Right.
Something that wasn't even on my radar 10 years ago. But yeah, a lot of these things wouldn't necessarily be on the radar of somebody who is 17, 18 years old. But for the most part, we're raised in a value system. And ultimately, what I try to do with the exercises in our course is just to, we all have these things that are kind of in the back of our minds, but I'm just trying to get them to actively engage these things and to write them down. So they're staring you right in the face. And we actually then ask people to see if it's even possible to put the values in some kind of an order from most important to least important. So you've got that idea when you are making these huge decisions. What is most important to you? And as I'm deciding what I want to do for a career and how I want to get trained for it, what should I be focusing on?
We're actually going to revisit your thoughts when you were 17 briefly here. College mistake number five, assuming you know yourself better than you do. The key to this was getting a firm grasp on who you are, what you want, and then proving it. And that's what we're going to be talking about in the conversation today. But in this piece, you are talking about your experience and your wife's experience. You guys co-wrote the book together. You say, overconfident, slightly rebellious, and heavily influenced by friends and the media, we made major life choices based on very little information. We honestly wish that someone had challenged our assumptions and introduced us to the idea that maybe, just maybe, we first needed to do some thorough research about our values, interests, skills, and options before committing to our chosen path.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, like that values piece is really absent, like an understanding of who we are. So both of us now, today we're collaborating, both bringing lots of like self-knowledge work into this. You know, the mission of School Sucks is helping young people achieve individual liberty through self-knowledge, self-teaching, and self-mastery. So this is obviously related to the work that you're doing as well. And man, there's a lot of obstacles to that in the culture, aren't there?
Oh, man. Yeah. as I've been thinking about it, you and I had our conversation about what this show was going to be about. It dawned on me because all of this liberty stuff and all of the things that you talk about, it talked about particularly in earlier episodes of School Sucks and things they talk about at Tragedy and Hope and on the Peace Revolution podcast. I wasn't aware that any of that existed up until just a few years ago. And I was really oblivious and naive to forces that are at work in our world that are kind of shaping things. And I, you know, I've just assumed that, you know, the world is kind of, you know, everyone did their thing and the world that we have is, you know, just a result of all of us living our lives and in our own various ways. And without even really thinking about the possibility that there could be forces somewhere that are trying to mold and shape. I mean, I understood that through, you know, advertising, they're trying to get us to purchase this product or whatever, but I never really realized how pervasive it was. And as I was really thinking about this, I was thinking about this Edward Bernays quote. And if I'm remembering correctly, Edward Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud.
Indeed. Yep.
And was one of the hugely influential people who helped shape early 20th century, particularly in the advertising realm. I mean, we have Edward Bernays to thank for the fact that, you know, women started smoking because he came up with the whole, you know, Liberty Torches campaign that got it to be cool for women to smoke.
Getting women to start smoking was actually one of the best things Edward Bernays was ever responsible for. I mean, if we were really to rank them all.
Perhaps. But I ran across the quote, which I'm sure you've heard many, many times. You probably even said it on the show. It goes like, "The conscience and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, ideas suggested largely by men we've never heard of." And
yeah.
They
who pull the wires that control the public mind.
Yeah. And honestly, when I wrote Test Drive Your Future, you know, these years ago, I had no idea that that was happening. And dialing that back to what I was like when I was 17 years old, I mean, I'm embarrassed to admit. I mean, I think I said in the last show, I used to watch a lot of television. And I remember, I'm really, really embarrassed to admit this, but I mean, there was a period of time while I was in high school that my buddies and I talked like, you know, Beavis and Butthead for months. And I'm like, oh my God. And that was just one element. It was like every time something new came out, you're like, oh, well, you know, then it was Ren and Stimpy or South Park or whatever, how we're molded by those cultural influences. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, for me, I remember being in college and we spoke to each other in Billy Madison. Let's just talk a little bit about Bernays. Okay, so this quote comes from a book that I recently revisited with my friends at Online Great Books. It was written in the late 1920s and it's called Propaganda. Mm-hmm. And Bernays is a shockingly unapologetic, amoral person who lived, I think, into the 90s and was doing interviews certainly as late as the 1980s, who's operating since the 1910s. One of Bernays's greatest, air quotes, achievements is helping the U.S. enter World War I under the promise that it would make the world safe for democracy. And democracy is an interesting factor in all of this as well, right? Because right. When you have systems where the totalitarianism is more overt right from the beginning by the design of the system, right? And a lot of like very far left like communism or far right like fascism, those systems are going to have a finite life because the control is so palpable. Right. Like in all of like the libertarian kinds of things and all the people that I've met through like the Free State Project or various events, it's very, very common that people are drawn to those ideas because they have a powerful story about knowing what it's like to be unfree. Right. I was in jail. I was in the military. We all have that story. Right. If we live consciously through those 15,000 hours of schooling, man, is there a better example than that? You know, asking permission to speak and to pee. Right. That's pretty extreme. But because of like the slow boil, it just seems so normal. And we don't know anything about the world outside of that. And on a grander scale, this democratic thing is the same way. We spend our whole lives learning that we can participate, that we're free, that we have choice. I mean, my goodness, 2016, I didn't see much choice as far as like desirable options. Right. And like what the future of the country was going to be. Right. But there's a slow boil kind of there as well, because over the last, I mean, you could start this at World War I. You could start this with the creation of the Federal Reserve. There's various checkpoints along the way where it intensifies. Obviously, post 9/11 is a huge one where the controls are increasing. The freedom is decreasing. We still might live, I would say, in one of the, if not the freest country in the world. But that's like that measurement system is kind of unsatisfactory to me as well, comparing it to other countries. So in a democratic society, obviously, these kinds of operators and wire pullers understood that behind the scenes, things needed to be controlled, that it needed to be not palpable, that it needed to be not perceivable by most people. and that anything else was just too dangerous. I mean, this is so explicit in the writing of the progressives who shaped the education system and so many other aspects of our society in the first two decades of the 20th century. They were terrified of the average person.
Right.
You know? And it's not to say their fears were completely unfounded either, right? Just to humanize them a little bit. But a lot of their attempts to scientifically manage society quickly got out of control. Some slowly got out of control. But there's also like a pretty strong, by the year 2020, a pretty strong cumulative effect of all of these efforts, of all of these different interests that have been going on since the late 19th century in this country.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've just, you know, we're the frog in the pot, and they've been very slowly turning up the heat for the last 100 years. And I was just reading an article this morning that was talking, it was like a poll of young Democrats, and they were talking about how nearly 50% of Democrats under 30 are saying they believe that there are a lot of other countries that are better than the United States. They're actually very okay with the fact that there are other countries that are rising up to the level of superpower status that might be able to challenge our authority. And they also done this poll with Democrats who were over 50, and none of that was present. So you can very much see how things have been shaped and how just through the generations, what the older segment believes and younger segment believes are really very different. And you can see how through this very subtle manipulation that we've had going over the past decades, how it really falls quite in line with the idea of bringing down the United States and indoctrinating us into more of a one world kind of mindset.
You know, geez, oh man, I hope we get to the topics we were going to talk about today, because this could erupt into a half an hour right here. Back to Bernays and advertising, right? Public relations. Propaganda was rebranded public relations as a smooth public relations move after the Nazis started using the word propaganda, as the legend goes. And today, the kids who are immersed in all of these like critical decisions that we're going to talk about, they have targets all over them. And obviously, a lot of that has to do with marketing and advertising and understanding like the properties of adolescence, like where the adolescent brain is at and how to take advantage of it. But in the last 5 years, we've seen a really, really powerful political push, right, to do kind of political marketing towards these kids. And I'm sure that's always existed. I'm sure that's existed at least since the 1960s. And I'm sure there were designs on that all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century when the concept of adolescence was invented. But in the last 5 years, it's become really, really gross. So, you know, I always give the example of things like climate change and gun control, where it seems like the attempt of some of the most powerful people in the world, as far as political operators are concerned, are trying to harness that rebellious spirit, that angst of teenagers, to get them to promote like the most establishment causes. So the, you know, the example that I always give, I'm sure my audience is tired of it, is Al Gore makes a sequel to his movie from like maybe 15 years ago called An Inconvenient Truth. And the sequel is called Truth to Power. Right? Like, come speak truth to power with me. Come be a rebel by promoting the UN's Agenda 21 climate change policies, right? Because you're like an angsty teen. And
right,
that's what you should do.
Be a rebel by promoting the biggest establishment of them all.
Right. So a lot of this desire to be free, teenagers feel, that manifests as rebelliousness or angst, is actually being recruited to like freedom smashing agendas. Climate change is just one. I mean, think about like Parkland and gun control. It's another huge example that we all had endure in the
David
last
Hogg
few years.
David Hogg and Greta. Greta's on her way to Davos to lecture the world leaders again about climate change. Oh man.
Well, that's actually like, at first I didn't have time for Greta. Like, I didn't really have time to dig in and be thoughtful about Greta. But now I'm kind of watching with interest, and I'm kind of rooting for her, that we are going to get to see her. this is a long shot. Maybe Greta wakes up, right? Greta's 15, 16 years old. Maybe she gets to be 18 and she says, holy shit, I am being used, right? I'm a product This is right. disgusting. How dare you use me as a product? Maybe that will happen. It has happened before. Actually, one of the Parkland kids, Cameron Caskey, did a really nice 180. And even though he still might identify as a progressive and might be for more gun control, he recognizes that his tactics, that his rhetoric was totally unhelpful, that he really went into the cause very blindly. He had a really good conversation with Ben Shapiro maybe like a year and a half ago about this. And that was like a really encouraging thing to see. And it's never been easier for people to have those kinds of revelations. Like, the media landscape is a huge cacophony, obviously, but people have, I think today, a better chance of like hearing something that knocks them out of their comfort zone or gets them thinking in new ways. Obviously, we see a lot of reinforcement to keep people in the echo chambers they're already in, but it doesn't mean that every once in a while, a really key figure is going to burst through and start thinking for themselves. And that would be a wonderful thing if it happened with this girl, Greta. I would love to watch that. I would love to watch that.
It was, I read another article last night, which is actually pretty interesting, revealing the degree to which she's being used. Facebook did an update over the weekend, and there was a bug in the update, and for a very brief time, it revealed where posts on people's accounts were coming from. And you could see for this brief window
I love it.
That Greta's things that she had posted were actually being posted, one, by her father, and two, by this handler who's in India. And I can't remember who that was, but he's some mucky muck in the whole climate change movement there. And it's like, oh, well, these posts that she's putting up aren't even hers. I mean, we could have assumed that maybe, but there it was in, you know, screenshotted and up on the internet.
So we have these celebrity examples, right? We have David Hogg, we have Greta, but this was done to all of us. We didn't all make it to the spotlight. Like I've said before, I would have taken the spotlight if it had been offered to me at that age. If somebody said, hey, do you want to feel powerful and meaningful while you just sit around all day filling out worksheets, I probably would have said yes. I probably wouldn't have asked too many questions, right? To get a real sense of self-efficacy in my life, like David Hogg got, like Greta gets, I would have gone for that at 16. So, but this happened to all of us. And, you know, what we're encouraging is this question. And I think we've both asked it in our work in a variety of forms. Have you, young person, ever stopped to reflect on how you became who you are? You know?
Right.
And what are the factors that contribute to that? You know, another thing I was thinking while we were talking about all this stuff, have you ever heard the phrase full spectrum dominance?
No.
Okay. So full spectrum dominance is a military term, right? It's also a full spectrum superiority is another way this is said. In a military engagement, in like a takeover, the invading force is able to harness control over all dimensions of the battle space, right?
Okay.
So it's like all of the resources, control of the air, control of the water, control of what's underwater, control of the psychological, the biological, all technology, all resources. That is full spectrum dominance in a takeover, right? And the term has been extended to the impact of scientific managers on their own population, right? And I think in Bernays's time, you know, like 80 years ago, that was closer to reality. There were fewer competing interests. And now I think it's more diverse. There's like more of an active information war with various interests. Because like full spectrum dominance suggests that it's being done by one group. And I don't kind of go for the it's all one group. It's a variety of groups looking to exert control over the democratic public. I mean, even if we look at education. Right. Even if we just look at even if we just look at public schooling in the United States,
there you go.
You know, I think about what my nieces and nephews are subjected to. Right. So they go to school and they have curriculum which still contains residuals from No Child Left Behind, mostly based on Common Core. And that's also mixed in with things like transgender indoctrination, right? Or like very agenda-driven, I don't want to be unsympathetic to that, but like very agenda-driven in some really, really disgusting ways. Like, oh, person going through puberty, you don't feel comfortable in your own body. In this health class, you'll learn that maybe you're in the wrong body. Like that kind of stuff. Those are definitely competing interests, right? Like No Child Left Behind is corporate interests. It's corporations coming together and basically ordering what they want out of the schools. Common Core is an extension of that. It's saying we need more people for the service industry. While, you know, any of this sort of social justice education is coming out of progressive identity-based programs in universities. So that's not all one group, right, working together. Corporations, when they see the way the wind blows, can obviously take advantage of these things in certain ways, but there are definitely like many different players in this field, all for one reason or another, seizing on the minds of children for some kind of objective.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's really obvious why they're doing it. I mean, I've been reading a book called The Fourth Turning recently. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I haven't.
I meant to mention it in the last show and I didn't get a chance. It essentially talks about how the world works in 80-year cycles. And 80 years, essentially, by the time you've reached 80 years. So right now, we're about 80 years out from World War II. And the last World War II veterans are dying. There are very few left. And so the firsthand knowledge of what was happening at that time is literally going away. And they're saying that in the book that about every 80 years, there is a major crisis because you've gotten to the point where the people who lived through the crisis are no longer there. They're no longer to share the knowledge of how horrible the crisis was. And therefore, the cycle repeats.
Oh, dang. And, have you heard the strong man, weak man quote?
No, I have not.
Okay. Strong men make good times. Good times make weak men. Weak men make bad times. Bad times make strong men. Strong men make good times. And then that's
a
circle.
Yes. Now that you say that, I have heard that quote many times. And I was at one point going to actually suggest to you that perhaps a good interview would be this guy named Stefan Arnio, who wrote a book last year called Hard Times Create Strong Men. And I've actually listened to the book three or four times this last year. It's a wonderfully insightful book. The guy is very not at all politically correct. He's just telling it like it is. And that's where I learned about this whole fourth turning thing is because he talks in the book about how the world runs through 80-year cycles. And what we were just talking about in how hard the culture is hitting the youth right now is you've got the baby boomers who are all, so baby boomers were very different from the World War II generation. They weren't as patriotic. They weren't as steeped in the values that made America great, as prior generations were. But right now, in that regard, they're the best we have. And then you have us in Generation X who are a little more removed from that. And then the millennials who are even more removed from that. And right now, I think the best hope, unfortunately, that we have for maintaining some of these values is found in the baby boomer generation. And they are getting into their elder years. They're having less influence in the culture than they had in the past. And as long as the as popular culture and these forces continue to just, hammer on the youth, I think that we could have an incredible shift in our society in the next, 20 to 40 years, because the baby boomers are going to be gone. You and I are going to be too old to really do much about it. And the people who are going to be coming into the prime of their lives are these people that think that socialism is great.
So, yeah, this change might not be filled with delights.
I don't think so at all. I'm trying to remember, the interview that G. Edward Griffin did with in the early 80s. And they talked about the studies that they did in the 50s about how they were trying to figure out how to comfortably merge the United States and the Soviet Union.
Norman Dodd.
Yep. And it seems to me that plan is still very much in place. I mean, the Soviet Union is long gone, but it seems just the way things are going in our society that plan is still very, very much a part of what's happening.
For the sake of just a spectacular tangent right here, can we actually dig into that for a second? Because I know there's people in the audience going, wait, merge the United States with the Soviet Union in the 1950s, where they seem to be so opposed to each other, like that might just not register with some
right.
people.
Yeah, this is where I wish I could channel Richard Grove, he'd be able to speak very eloquently on this. But I know, and maybe you know it better. I mean, they were talking, was it the Dodd Commission in the 1950s, where Congress convened and actually did a whole study about it was the influence that the nonprofit foundations of the tycoons of the day, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and all that, how all of that money and the influence of the nonprofits were changing and shaping society. And I know you've touched on that quite a bit in earlier podcast episodes and the way that those foundations sought to shape education.
Sure. And one of the aspects of that was sort of like Atlanticism, right? Like the idea of reuniting the United States with Great Britain.
Yes.
Was a part of that as well. So, I mean, obviously, even if neither of us are qualified to speak on all of the findings of the Dodd Commission, we can say there has been a concerted effort since the end of World War II to basically merge all states into one, or at least to have them all governed by one, even if they maintain some level of independence, which obviously means, like, I'm a nationalist before I'm that, you know, even though there's endless problems with nationalism. Nationalism at least takes it closer to the individual, right? If individual right. liberty is the goal and you have to make an ally with a nationalist or two to do that, at this point, you know, seeing the efforts, seeing, you know, the agendas of things like the United Nations, various efforts to merge all these states together in Europe, and the problems that Britain has had exiting the European Union, like I'm leaning that way, right? I'm leaning the nationalist way, even though I'm certainly no nationalist.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because it's the closest thing that we have that can help us maintain our individual liberty. I mean, and that's that's one of the values that is most important to me and has certainly been highlighted these last few years, in particular since I've become a parent. You know, because I've read all these articles recently about these you know, sex education and some other things that are being, you know, enforced in different states, public school curriculum. I mean, I am not a prude, but there are certain things that I don't think that you should be teaching 6-year-olds. And
I don't think strangers should be teaching them for as part of some kind of an agenda.
Exactly. And so the idea of this nationalism in relation to our individualism has become very important to me in these last few years, simply for the fact that I don't believe that this technocratic elite has a better idea of how to raise my daughter than I do. And I want to be able to make these choices for what I'm going to expose her to and when and how we're going to about it, so I can shape her into being a good moral person who makes a positive contribution to society.
Yeah, and gets happiness out of that as a result. So to back all the way out of this, right, which is a long way out, there's lots of voices whispering in our ears, our entire lives, our collective ears. Those are all, like, you know, children, adolescents. We don't really get an opportunity, most of us anyway, to audit our beliefs, our values, ask where they came from, and then through that process to understand if they really define us, if we really want them, if that's really what we're all about. So
right.
I wanted to just shift into a conversation about how to do that, about how you encourage people to do that through your work.
Absolutely. And the reason that we wrote our books and that we created our course was, I mean, so I talked in the last show how Beth and I felt like we needed to physically remove ourselves from society in order to have the space that we needed to do this, which is why we left Seattle and moved to a goat farm in the middle of nowhere on the Big Island of Hawaii.
I love it. It's very transcendentalist. It is.
Well, it seemed like a really good idea at the time. And we were also, I mean, I didn't realize it, but we were being heavily influenced by all of the climate change propaganda then. You know, I remember watching this PBS documentary at the time called Race to Save the Planet. And it was like gloom and doom about how our modern industrial society was just going to destroy the earth. And part of my wanting to move to that goat farm was, I mean, I was going to learn how to milk goats and take care of chickens. And we were planting crops. And I mean, the guy we were living with was on the way far spectrum of that, believed that everybody on the planet should be given an acre of land through which they could tease their living. And I really went back to have this back to the land experience to explore whether this was actually part of my values or not. The real reason for wanting to do that was having this chance to do the self-exploration, but that was really a part of who I thought I was then. And I wanted to test drive it,
yeah.
So to speak, by, you know, can I go out and actually do this? And I found, having been out there, that I was not happy. That was among the most miserable time of my life. And, I'm glad that I had that experience. I'm glad I learned that about myself. I'm glad that I had the hours and hours and all of the time that I did to read and all of the journaling that I did. But I definitely recognize that that is not feasible or even desirable for the vast part of the population.
Right. So it was transcendentalist in its motivation and transcendentalist in its results. Yeah,
not everyone can have their own Walden moment. So what we sought to do was to just try to take what we had done there and put it into a 4 or 5 chapters of a book to get people as close to that process as we could without them having to go nearly to that extreme.
So what are the elements of that?
Well, ultimately, the one that I really wanted to talk about today was really getting into your values. And backing up a little bit, I had this conversation with my dad over the weekend, and his values were very much related to getting married, starting a family, and being a good provider. So in that regard, I mean, so my father worked in a John Deere factory for 35 years, and he didn't have to focus a whole lot on his values, because it was like all he had to do was get up and show up and work and do his job all day, and that was cool. But that part of our economy is significantly smaller than what it used to be. And I think now that he's older and he has a chance to reflect, he's like, he worked from 3 p.m. till midnight the whole time I was growing up. And so he really didn't get to participate much in my sisters and my upbringing. And I definitely think that he has regrets about that. And the cool thing about it seems like we have a lot more options today than maybe my dad did when he was just getting into his career in the 1970s. And so we have a lot more things to think about in relation to those options, and just the idea that you could take some time and really figure out what's important to you. And I mean, there's so many more people who are pursuing, higher education or different types of educational experiences that would allow for different types of careers that didn't exist a few decades ago.
There's just more searching, and that's a positive thing. Even if people are landing in the wrong places, that the search is happening, I think, is something to be optimistic about.
Absolutely. And taking the time to really figure out what your values are before you make these big decisions, you know, like if you really value family, then try to get a career that doesn't involve you working during the time you'd be interacting with your kids, or doesn't have you working 80 hours a week. Because there are plenty of careers out there that would consume your life if you let it. And you could get into something like that and find that you were completely missing the mark.
Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about an exercise that you have in the book called Check Your Gauges. And then I want to talk about a couple of self-exploration exercises that I've done that I would certainly, I mean, I think in this show, we're talking more to parents who are trying to help their children. And I think a lot of them are people who are not following traditional school paths, so they already have a leg up there, but they're trying to help their children navigate these decisions. That's who I feel like we're serving most through the conversations that we're going to have. But I also think that it has the benefit of helping everybody reflect on their experiences, especially if they're not 100% satisfied with where they've wound up at 25 or 30 or 35 or 40.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's fantastic. And I'm actually happy to provide a resource for your listeners. What I want to do is I want to take this Check Your Gauges section of our book, you know, which is just 4 or 5 pages of PDF, and make that available as a download so people could actually go through. We have a list of about 200 values that you could go through and kind of choose the ones that mean the most to you. And then you could, you know, star the ones that are absolutely most important. If you really felt like it, you could go through and, you know, rate them from 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, just so you could get an idea of what is absolutely most important, your core values, and then kind of what are your secondary values that kind of reinforce your primary values. So we'll definitely make that available as a download. And I'm so glad that we had all these tangential conversations today, because I said I wanted to provide as much value to your audience as possible. I don't know that most young people would be able to quite be able to explore the sources of all of their values in the way that we discussed. That's something that I didn't think about, certainly until I was older. But I thought, if, you know, based on what we talked about, if the older members of your audience also want to do the values exercise, but then because they're so aware of what's going on in the world, that they would be able to better explore the sources of where those values came from.
So you don't think that's necessarily a project for a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old to undertake?
I would love to think that they I know they could. I mean, they definitely can. It's just whether they would choose to. I'm wondering if it would take a particularly driven or motivated person to really figure that out.
I think it requires a bit of wisdom, right? I think you have to have come to a place that you want to leave a situation that you're not in love with to be motivated to make that kind of change. Tell me what you think of this. I think the identification of values, there might be like a should implied in there, right? By identifying your values, then the outcome would be, well, this is where you should go, or this is what you should do, or this is how you should get there.
Yes, there is. It's kind of a should implied, but we, through the book, this is just the first of several exercises where we try to peel back the onion of who you are. And then once you've done that, you've identified your you know, skills, interests, values, hopes, dreams, then I was talking with Chris McMillan about this yesterday, and we were talking about, I am embarrassed to think that I hadn't seen our project in this way before, that this whole first section is like the grammar stage. And then the second, once you've done all of this, the second part of it is actually getting into the logic where you're actually trying to figure out, you're synthesizing everything that you've learned about yourself in the grammar stage and trying to make logical sense of it.
Okay.
And so,
that's more the establishment of a how.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And there really aren't any shoulds, because I think that once you get into the logical stage, there are so many options with how you could plug in what you've learned about yourself, that when I think of should, I think of something you should do that you don't necessarily want to do.
And maybe it's super specific, right? If it's yeah, something you're being forced to do, it's obviously, yeah, it's going to be a pretty narrow thing. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. And the whole point of this test drive process is to find something that is a really good match for who you are and what you want out of life. I mean, ideally, we're trying to lead young people to find work that doesn't necessarily feel like work.
Right. Now, I just asked because, like, in the context of the whole thing, right, of like planning for the future, which we could say is a part of it, well, obviously you have to start taking steps, right? So from that starting point of establishing values, then what's the next step? And how many different steps can you take? And you're right, there's a lot of them.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you familiar at all with self-authoring or the art of self-discovery?
Probably. I mean, in an informal way, yes. But if you're familiar with a formal way of doing that, or something someone else has already established, I'd love to hear about it.
Oh, these are two things that I tried in the last 5 years. I've done both. So self-authoring was Jordan Peterson's program. Okay. And it had past authoring, present authoring, and future authoring. And, you know, future authoring, I think, might be more aligned with what we've been talking about here. The only exercise series that I completed was past authoring, which is a really confronting exercise on finding out who you are and why you are that way. So, mm-hmm. like, the basic practice is you divide your life, as it has happened so far, into 7 epochs, right?
Oh.
And so right there, you have to say, well, geez, what are the events that shifted me from one period of life to another period of life?
Brilliant.
Then you kind of go through and you identify the most significant events that occurred in each epoch, and you sort of write, not super subjectively, about how each one of those experiences contributed to who you are today. The Art of Self-Discovery is a book by Nathaniel Brandon. I'm actually going to flip my camera on here for a minute, Jim, so you can see this thing.
Okay.
Can you see that?
I can, yes.
This book is basically being held together by the will of the gods at this point. I'm afraid to even open it. I did mark a page. I didn't want to bunny ear. What's that called? Dog ear page?
Dog ear, yeah.
Dog ear page. So I just put a bookmark in it because I was worried it would break the page. Brandon's explanation of the sentence completion exercise, basically it's just a prompt to write about. And he divides the book into all these different sections of self-exploration, like your relationship with your parents is a huge part of it. And he says, when we give ourselves to sentence completion, we entered an altered state of consciousness. So the idea, again, non-judgmentally, is he'll give you a prompt, it will end with a dot, dot, dot. And your goal is just to write 10 to 12 endings without, you know, overthinking them. That's basically nice. The exercise. We are able to let go of everyday analytical, worrying, doubting mode of consciousness and allow another part of the mind, the subconscious, to do its work. As I tell my clients, thinking and analyzing can be fine, but we do them later as a separate mental activity in a separate context. Often, however, we find that very little analysis is needed because the material we produce is almost entirely self-explanatory. What we do need, particularly for the generation of change, is to spend significant time simply looking at the endings we produce and silently meditating on them. This needs to be emphasized because one of the prime ways we can resist growth is to run from our own sentence completion as quickly as possible, a policy that hardly serves us. So that, like, in the context of this book, he's saying run from your own sentence completion, but that can be expanded to mean a lot of things, like a lot of these self-exploration type exercises not being done. And obviously, when we think about them not happening at this age, the consequences can be, you know, like unfortunate and expensive.
Right.
So the art of self-discovery, again, probably a difficult exercise for a lot of teens to do, or for parents to like motivate their teens to do. And I would say, like, you also have this problem, like Stefan Molyneux used to say, I'm basically making diet books for thin people.
Right.
You know, so like the kind of parent who would encourage a young person to do something like the art of self-discovery, that young person is probably in of everybody in the culture, one of the people who needs it the least if they have parents who are thinking on that level about the development of their child. But for the people who are listening who are, you know, in a different stage of life, this is certainly a worthwhile exercise, as is the self-authoring thing. But that was a tangent because I would recommend that people check out the work that Peterson did on future authoring, which is another type of deep dive you can do into this kind of planning.
I loved the idea of the epochs too. That's really cool. I mean, just going back to the beginning of our conversation, I was very obviously in a very different epoch when I created my values list, 10, 12 years ago than I am now.
Same here. There's also like easier exercise, like less in-depth exercises, less confronting. You and I, in our show prep, we talked about disc styles, which is not like this deep, uncomfortable exploration, but more of like a behavioral evaluation, right?
Oh, I absolutely love the disc styles. And that was not always the case because it's been presented by a number of different people in a number of different ways. And I used to belong to this business networking group. I met with every Tuesday for 7 years, and they talked about the disc styles a lot. And I found it to be so boring. I just couldn't wrap my head around it. In joining autonomy, Richard came at it from a very different place called the gem styles, and you've got rubies and emeralds and sapphires, and it has the same meaning, but I didn't find it to be particularly as applicable in my life as I wanted it to be. And so, knowing how valuable this information is and desperately wanting to wrap my simple mind around it, I started doing some Google searching, and I found a book. I can't remember the author right now, but the book's title is Taking Flight. And the guy breaks the disc styles up, and he represents each of the styles with a bird. And I immediately just gravitated toward this explanation of discs, and I found it to be incredibly useful in my life, and have really enjoyed using that to teach other people. And that's actually one of the modules that I added to my course just a few months ago, was going into the disc styles in the way that this author explains, because I think it's by far the most understandable, approachable, and useful, not just for young people, but I think of anyone of any age.
Yeah, it's used in professional development a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Or like corporate, like team building, it's also part of exercises that would occur there.
Right. And when they use that language, it's just really hard to grasp and kind of boring. But in the way that they approach this, I can do a very brief overview if you're interested. If not, we can save that for another
time. No, absolutely. I would love to do that because I think it fits into this conversation well, as far as like ways that young people can acquire more self-knowledge in ways that don't have like super high levels of resistance, right?
Right.
Like, you know, is the average, like, self-authoring, aside from future authoring, is probably not going to be an undertaking for most teens. Neither is the art of self-discovery, right? Like, most people, I think, start looking for things like that when they reach an age like 35. That was Pete Gerlach's age, where people start to have like serious questions about the lives they've led and why they've led them and what caused them to lead them that way. Like, 35 is when most people kind of get into that area. So the point of bringing those up was they're things that parents can look into and then maybe sort of implicitly incorporate into what they're doing for guidance. But this is something that is far more practical, right? This is something that a teen could just go right at now if they wanted
to. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they would be able to, at the level we're talking about, they'd be able to start figuring things out just based on what I'm going to say here in a couple minutes. In the online course version of Test Drive Your Future, the module that talks about this is called What Bird Are You? And essentially, I mean, like I say, again, we can have another conversation where we go into the specific disc styles more because there's a lot more detail than what I have right on top of my mind.
Just so everybody understands what we're about to talk about, DISC is an acronym. The D stands for dominance, the first personality type. The I stands for influence, the second personality type. The third is steadiness, and the fourth is conscientiousness. Now, Jim is going to match a bird up with each one of these, and then we're going to discuss it. So, dominance, Jim?
Dominance being the eagle.
Okay. Influence?
Parrot.
Steadiness?
The dove.
And conscientiousness?
The owl.
Excellent.
And if you just think about those birds and think about their personalities, you already have a sense of what I'm talking about. And so the eagle is kind of a go-getter. You know, the personality that's the take charge kind of, you know, take action and maybe think about it later. And then the I would be the parrot. And you're thinking of your parrot as kind of your fun-loving, happy-go-lucky, let's everybody get along kind of person. And that's part of who I am. You're not strictly one of these things. You're often a combination of them. The S would be the dove, which is that person who wears their heart on their sleeve. Very emotional, very sensitive. And actually, I am primarily a dove, but I have elements of the parrot mixed in with me because given the right environment and given the right circumstances, I can be very social and very exuberant and very talkative. But in other circumstances, I'm really very quiet and very introspective. And, you know, I'm the wallflower at the dance, so to speak. And the last one, the C, is the owl. And you're thinking about the very inquisitive, the very studious, the egghead. And my wife is very much the owl. And she loves her spreadsheets. She's a web designer. She loves to sit in front of her desk all day and work with code and all of that, all the things that would drive me crazy. And you think about what all of these different elements and how they would fit into your career. And so just on a very surface level, you know, if you're that type of go-getter, the eagle, you would probably look for a career that allowed you for to be in a position of leadership, that take charge kind of person, go out and get them kind of maybe sales, something like that, where the I would be more of that that public relations kind of thing. You're out, you're working with the community, you're trying to sell people on ideas. You're like, oh, wasn't this the greatest thing you ever heard of? You know, the dove would be more of your quiet, maybe counseling type, where you're trying to have these open communications with people, really dive into their feelings, things like that. And then you've got the C's who would be doing the very technical aspects of society that some of the other styles wouldn't really want to touch.
Absolutely. And again, this is just a model. Like, I have a lot of skepticism about like personality profiles. Like, I think of Myers-Briggs, and right. I've known and spoken to people who are like really, really put a lot of stock in Myers-Briggs, but I've done it multiple times. I've been an ENTP. I've also been an INFP, right? Mm-hmm. There's this sort of culture where people like build these whole plans for life around that identity. And I didn't find that one particularly helpful. I think DISC is a little bit different, but it's not intended to be like ultimately defining. It's just useful information. And there's lots of different assessments for DISC that you can do online. So it's useful to understand that to avoid comparison, right? Like, you see somebody, I see lots of people who do things similar to what I do as far as work is concerned. And I go, oh, why do we do it so differently? Why can't I do it as well as they appear to do it? And some of the answers might lie in just completely different approaches that could be uncovered through an assessment like this. So that, and absolutely, I think that would be much more useful to a younger person who might have a harder time with that kind of comparison to other people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you're getting, by knowing these styles, you're getting a better idea of who you are. But in the books, they talk a lot about, I really love these books. And the first half of the book is like essentially an explanation of the different styles and the birds and how they relate. And then the second half of the book is all stories of these birds interacting with one another in the woods and showing how the different styles work together. And the other really brilliant thing about the system, they kind of teach you how to, in the first few minutes you've met somebody, be able to kind of figure out what that person's style is so that you might be able to interact with them in a much easier way. You kind of meet them where they are and help facilitate that communication. So if you're an owl and you've met an eagle, you can't speak owl language to them because they will just tune out. But if you can, if you know how to do it, if you can relate to them on their level, that is going to open up the conversation in ways that wouldn't have been possible. And if you're working together on something, if you allow the different people on the team to express their strengths, everyone will be able to contribute in their own unique way. Not everybody needs to be the eagle. Not everybody needs to be the dove, but you just kind of figure out how you can all work together to achieve your common goal.
Right. And there we see the benefits of grammar as well, right? Definition. Like, not to put people in a box. Like, sometimes people get hostile in political conversations and they start calling each other names like, oh, you're just one of these. And they categorize somebody as something they're comfortable arguing against, like kind of straw manning, like right. That's an extreme version of this. But there's a more balanced way to do it where if, you know, you can identify like, oh, OK, so you pretty much fit here. If you're being constructive about it, not hostile about it, you know how to work with somebody. It's one of the great benefits of our age as far as social interaction is concerned is that so many more things, like so many more types of behaviors are defined today. Right. So like I'll give an example. White knighting, you know, an online problem develops in like a Facebook thread or something. A man comes to the rescue of a woman and this man does this again and again. And you watch this man do this on Facebook over the course of the year. And ultimately you say, God, that guy's a dickhead. I can't stand him. Today, you actually have. But that never had a name. Right. That was never a thing until recently, as far as like, you know, a term used in that way. So today you actually have a behavior that you can point to. And instead of saying, get lost, dickhead, you could say, hey, Greg, I don't like it when you do this. And this is this thing. This is the definition of the thing that you do that I don't like. Right. So there's almost like there's more precision in dealing with people. Again, if you want to take a constructive approach, it can just as much be used as a term of dismissal and derision if you want it to. But the potential exists because of the way things are defined just in the social space that people could actually get along better. And obviously, like DISC was designed to do that. So it can be really helpful if you harness it that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're not really labeling or pigeonholing somebody. I think with this particular explanation of DISC, I think people really enjoy it and they get it right away. Like, oh yeah, I am an eagle. And they, you know,
they love it. Yeah,
they love it. Yeah. But eagles especially love being eagles.
Right. We had one more thing that we talked about ahead of time that we were going to discuss today. This is a fun one. It's an important one. Love languages.
Right?
Understanding who you are. This is a really key thing when it comes to happiness, right? It extends beyond, I would say, just romantic relationships, but that's pretty much what it's built out of. I want to hear you talk about why you wanted to include this in this conversation.
Oh, well, again, it's just another means of getting to know yourself. And again, maybe this one probably wouldn't be as applicable for younger people, but thinking about the older members of your audience, the parents, this is the Love Languages book is something that my wife and I have been going through for the last few months, and it has been fantastic. It's been transformed. I mean, Beth and I have been together. We've been married 19 years. We've been together 20 years, and we have always gotten along really well, and we really enjoy each other's company, and we communicate very well, but. Honestly, the love language, we've been sitting down with the iPad, maybe once a week the last few months and just knocking out a section at a time. And it has been so enjoyable. And we've just been marveling at how, after having been together for so long, that we can continue to learn more about each other and to allow that to improve our relationship in ways that we really didn't think were possible after 20 years.
That's beautiful. Would you mind, I know it's personal, would you mind giving one example?
In the book, they talk about trying to figure out what your love language is.
Yeah.
And they've got like, you know, physical touch and acts of service and kind words. I should have done a better job of preparing.
I'll run through them. I know them. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, actually. Words of affirmation, acts of service. And we can kind of explain maybe through examples what each one of these are. They're all pretty self-explanatory, so it's kind of efficient here. Receiving gifts, quality time, and physical touch.
Right.
So in other words, like which one of these things, these things kind of work in a hierarchy too, best signals receiving love to you. The other benefit of this is if you can identify it in a partner, right? What their hierarchy is. I mean, you should do what Jim and Beth are doing and ask each other and do this together. I mean, that is magical as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have an activity in the back of the book. You can take a quiz and it kind of helps you determine what your love language is. And really, I mean, again, this is more of figuring out who you are and what your most important things are. And what I actually had this this discovery a few weeks ago, and the funny thing is in relation to when we recorded our last show, is determining that for me, the most important thing was words of appreciation. It's Beth and I were listening to our episode right after you released it a few weeks ago. We were driving up to the north part of the island to visit some friends and we had it on the radio. And Beth is like, she's got tears streaming down her face. Because she's listening to us talk and she's like, for me, she knows that this is like the realization of a dream come true, being able to have these conversations with you and to try to benefit your audience in whatever way I can. And when she talked about that over the following days, it meant so much to me that she had acknowledged what I had done and what I had built and how I had gotten into your sphere of influence to the point where I'd actually be able to have these conversations with you. And that was kind of a revelation to me because, I mean, we have such a good relationship. I mean, Beth and I, we share the housework, we share the cooking, we share chores, we do all of these things. But I didn't really realize how important the words of appreciation were for me until I read the book and then really started thinking about our interactions. And the other brilliant point of the book, besides figuring out these things about yourself, is then being able to figure out how you can speak your partner's love language in a way that they will have that same joy that I felt when Beth was speaking my language. I sit in the men's circle and we were talking a few weeks ago. This guy who's very familiar with the love languages and his love language was acts of service. And so his day off was Friday and he would vacuum the house and he would make dinner and he would do all of these things. He'd spend his whole day off preparing for his wife to get home. And then he'd say, look at all these things that I did for you, honey. Isn't that wonderful? And she'd be like, yeah, that's great. You know, she appreciated it, but it wasn't her love language. So it didn't have the same effect that he was hoping for.
Right.
Ultimately, you know, he could have gone to the store and bought her, you know, a $15 bottle of perfume or whatever. And if that is her love language, she would have been over the moon and much more appreciative than all of the 6 hours worth of work he'd done in the house that day.
Absolutely. And first of all, Jim, I just want to say, as a words of affirmation guy, what you said was wonderful. I really appreciate that. That was was very nice of you. Thank you.
Cool. But
as a words of affirmation guy, this is kind of the point I was trying to make is knowing these and just like if you just say to yourself or it's almost implicit, right? It doesn't have that definition. Again, back to definition where you know what you like, you know what makes you feel loved. So you're in a romantic situation and you say, you're so beautiful, you're really smart. And this could be a person, and I've dealt with this, who is just repelled by compliments, right? They just can't deal with it. And then there's just this friction and it never really gets understood or clarified or anything like that. By knowing what these are and then identifying them in a person that you love, you can learn to do what they need better, right? You can inventory your own weaknesses and be more conscious about improving those things, which is really, really beautiful, I think.
Absolutely.
Man, we did it. That was a lot of self-knowledge for teens.
Holy cow. A whole lot of self-knowledge for everyone, I'm hoping.
I hope so, too. So let's just summarize with like what I think the most practical takeaways are for young people. And I really think it's going to come down to, even though, yes, we expand all age groups here, it's really going to come down to tools like DISC assessment and values identification.
Right. As I'd promised earlier in the episode, I definitely wanted to make this exercise available to people. Like I said, we've got a list of about 200 values that you could go through and try to identify which are your most important. This is, again, the mile marker 2.1 in our book, and it's called Check Your Gauges. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to make that available at testdriveyourfuture.com/values. And so you could just download that, go through the exercise and try to figure out what your top values are, what's most important to you, and then how you might be able to take those into consideration as you're making these big decisions related to college and career for young people.
Excellent. Can you give us an example of how you lay out a specific value?
Oh, okay. Well, so ultimately what we have in there is a list of like 200 with a bunch of checkboxes next to them. For example, acceptance, achievement, acknowledgement, adventure. There's a large alphabetical list, and ultimately you should be able to find a number. I actually, when I went through my list earlier, I found like 35 out of the 200 that I really resonated with, and then pared it down to my, you know, 8 or 10 that I considered to be the most important. And reading through the list, it's kind of interesting because you can actually see the different DISC styles represented in the values, because there are certain things like achievement is not, you know, that idea of being a real go-getter is not important to me. So there are things in there that I resonate with a lot more than others.
Right. So if it was like optimism, collaboration, attention, that's me, right? That's I.
Right.
That's influence.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can see it in there.
Yeah. Education, gratitude, trustworthiness, honesty, and the making a difference in the world. I think that's probably something that's obviously very important to both of us, given what we're doing here.
Excellent. Absolutely. So that was the only other question I had was like some guidance on, you can cast a wide net in the beginning, and if you wind up with like 35 or 40, but ultimately you're trying to distill it to 10 that you can work with in a practical way.
Right. Yeah. And your top five are probably going to be ultimately, like I said, your core values. And then the other five will most likely be something that is in support of those.
I love it. Well, Jim, thank you for another great conversation. I can't wait until next month. And when we started doing this, we said we were going to do more like sounding of the alarm, like really pointing people to the problem here. But I couldn't be happier with how we didn't talk about a lot of problems today. Aside from the influence of Edward Bernays and the scientific managers that control us all. But lots of positivity, lots of constructive stuff in today's show. So thank you very much. I loved it.
You're welcome. And going through my list of values, humor and happiness are among the top. So I'm glad that we had a chance to focus on that part of the conversation.
Awesome. Me too. That was great.
To fall, I'll just think back.